Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Being Mexican in America, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Teresa Puente is a fourth-generation Mexican-American, and for her, identity is complicated, especially during this presidential election year.
Sometimes I identify as Mexican, sometimes I'll say Mexican-American, but sometimes I'll just say American, because that's what I am.
Also, how a garbage crisis on the streets of Beirut inspired a new recycling program.
Now your options are very limited. Either gonna bathe in your own garbage or you're gonna start looking at it differently. The best way to adapt is when you are in a crisis.
Plus, why did Turkey's president fly all the way to Kentucky for Muhammad Ali's funeral?
It's a long way to go for a boxer's funeral who wasn't Turkish.
That's all coming up today here on The World. Thank you for being here. We're kicking off the show today with a couple of stories of people who feel like strangers in a strange land. We'll hear from a Venezuelan who went home after years away and tries to find the country she once knew. But first, let's hear from someone in Illinois.
I have brown skin, wavy dark hair, and you know, in my lifetime, people have thought not only that I was Muslim, maybe I'm Indian, maybe I'm Turkish.
That's Teresa Puente. Puente was waiting to board a plane in Chicago the other day when a fellow passenger asked her, "Are you Muslim?" Puente says the question was accompanied by a glare.
And I replied, "No, I'm Mexican." And then I realized, oh no, actually I've moved from one group reviled by Donald Trump, Muslims, to another group, Mexicans.
Puente says she's been getting more questions from strangers about where she's from and that it's unsettling.
Fact is, I've heard that question my whole life, but I feel like it's increasing not just for me, but other people who don't meet the stereotype of what it means to be an American. So people like myself who are American-born have to sort of explain ourselves. Some people can't imagine that I'm actually American, and I think this is really a universal experience for people, whether they're whatever their ethnic background, if they don't sort of fit a stereotype. That's just something I've dealt with, but I know that it's increasing. There was a recent incident in the past week in North Carolina. A group of students at a high school built a wall out of cardboard boxes. That's intimidation of Latino students. And in this case, the high school said, oh, it's just a prank. They're not taking any action.
We've all heard presidential contender Donald Trump refer to U.S. District Judge Gonzalo Curiel as the Mexican, despite the fact that Curiel was born in Indiana as an American citizen. Maybe Trump's comments are not that surprising. What is surprising, though, to me anyway, is that these days you're feeling prouder than ever to be Mexican. Is that right?
Yeah, maybe we need to flip the script in a way. I can own that I'm American. I can own that I'm Mexican. Growing up, the American society in general doesn't allow me just to be American because I face these questions my whole life. And now with Trump, the questions just increase. What are you? Who are you? So I own both, and I'm proud of both.
You've been writing about your thoughts on identity in a recent article for Time magazine, Teresa. You talk a bit about your Mexican-American father who grew up in the 40s around San Antonio and your great-grandfather who rode a horse from Mexico to Texas in 1890. How different was the racial tensions that your forebears dealt with compared to what you've been dealing with?
My dad recalls very emotionally as a young boy, and he was born in San Antonio. He used to sell newspapers in the street in San Antonio, restaurants that had signs, "No dogs or Mexicans allowed." Mm. I thought that that era was gone, but with Trump again wielding Mexican as a racial slur, I feel like it's echoes of that horrible, horrible past. My mom also, who was born in Texas, but she grew up speaking Spanish first, was once locked in a closet by a teacher at school simply for speaking Spanish on the playground. Mm. You know, I'd hoped this was a thing of the past.
Yeah, so that airport experience is indicative of all of this. What do you think is the upshot of that moment and this whole moment in time for how you identify yourself?
The upshot is that we can be proud to be Mexican. We can be proud to be American. I am proud of my heritage. That defines a lot of who I am and the work I do. I think Trump is sort of mobilizing the greater Latino community, not just Mexicans, and to become have a greater political voice. But, you know, Mexican is not a dirty word.
Teresa Puente teaches journalism at Columbia College in Chicago. Really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Venezuelan, also not a dirty word, definitely not to journalist Mariana Zúñiga. She's originally from the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. But after 6 years in Europe, Zúñiga recently decided to move back home. She wanted to be close to her family and friends. But Zúñiga says that when she returned, she quickly realized all of her friends wanted to flee.
Well, many of them are actually looking to go abroad. Maybe just one wants to stay in the country because they have hope. They think that things are going to change, but it's kind of very difficult. We have mixed, many people have mixed feelings about staying or going abroad. There's also like you can feel how there's several things happening every day that you one feel that you're not living in a normal country. You're not living anymore in a normal society. Things are, you have this feeling that things are about to explode in any time.
Well, you wanted to cover a conflict. Does it feel like the economy in Venezuela is so bad, the security situation is so dicey that you are covering a conflict, maybe even a low-grade war?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I feel these kind of mixed feelings, because as a journalist, I feel like, okay, this is actually a lot of experience for me. This is kind of like great because I'm doing things and I'm reporting about something that matters and I'm telling people abroad what is happening in my country. But at the same time, I am also suffering this situation because it's not that I can live without having anything that I left behind. I have my grandma that can find her medicines. I have my brother that complains because he can have his breakfast with milk, for example. Or I have family members that ask to my mom, like, you know, I'm having economical issues. Could you lend me some money? I promise I'm going to pay you, but I can't pay the school of my daughter, of my cousin. So you say, like, you know, professionally speaking, I'm learning a lot, but I also feel affected. And it's kind of, yeah, these mixed feelings of feeling happy for my profession and feeling very, very sad about my family and about my friends that I'm seeing every day struggling. And not also that, like seeing people in the street that are looking for food in the garbage. I never saw this kind of a scene in my country. And I never imagined that we will reach this kind of point.
What has been the biggest change in Venezuela since you left, the one that's been most hard for you to adjust to?
Wow. I think the most difficult things to leave right now as a Venezuelan, and at least this is my opinion, but I think it's shared by many, is the fact of the lines to buy food. Those are seen like very, very hard things to see. And the fact of the insecurity. Like, I never felt so unsafe being outside of my house.
So, Mariana, what do you think your own future is going to look like? Are you determined to stay and document what happens to Venezuela? Or do you think you might leave, like most of your friends have?
Oh, to be honest, I don't know. I would like to stay and keep covering what is happening. In some way, I also feel kind of happy knowing that I'm with my family at the same time and we are kind of living this situation together. So in some way, I'm kind of happy that I could keep them company during this difficult time.
Mariana Zúñiga is a Venezuelan reporter just returned to Caracas from being overseas for several years. Thanks very much for your thoughts.
Oh, you're welcome, Marco.
Netflix has put a lot of time and money into creating original content for American audiences. Now it's taking that effort global. Last month, Netflix launched a series in French called Marseille. Not to worry, it's also dubbed and subtitled into English for non-French speakers. The series itself takes its name from the port city on France's southern coast. Aside from the French connection, France's second largest city doesn't get many starring roles. But as Emma Jacobs discovered, a lot of locals feel like this French connection does not connect.
In the first 5 minutes of Marseille, you see the mayor, played by Gerard Depardieu, doing cocaine, and then there's a violent jewelry store robbery. It's a pretty good indication of what's to come. Marseille has been compared to that other Netflix series, House of Cards. but it tells the story of a feud between Depardieu and his political protege, set against a city full of corruption, gangs, and the mafia. The series also features beautiful aerial shots of the city, especially its extremely blue harbor with historic forts framing the entrance. It's that combination that provokes mixed feelings here. I feel a little attacked personally, says Michael Bergerat, standing outside a restaurant a few blocks from the port. It's true that there are a lot of beautiful places, he says. On the other hand, what I didn't like were all the prejudices about Marseille. Marseille is often a cliché of delinquency, of problems with immigration. His friend Diana Salinitro jumps in. It doesn't reflect the image we have of it living here as locals, she explains. She brings up one of the violent scenes that frustrated her. Gang members firebomb the car of an emergency worker who refused to use it to move drugs for them. We live in a big city, she says. Whether it's Marseille, Paris, Lyon, there's violence, there's drug trafficking. Her point, Marseille is not that different from these other cities, even if it has a reputation as particularly troubled. Catherine Autier, who really likes this series in general, points out that it can be valuable to draw attention to violence in Marseille.
You hear about this all the time. You know, you wake up in the morning, you turn on the radio, and you hear, oh, well, the gang killing in the tunnel, and it's a fact of life in Marseille, and nobody really pays attention anymore. I mean, they'd rather a gang member be killed than, you know, a regular person.
But she agrees Marseille's got that in common with other cities. And Ingrid Precioso says, given how hard Marseille has been fighting old stereotypes to improve tourism, she was unhappy with what she saw. Honestly, she says, I'd prefer if they'd give Marseille a different image. Precioso owns a secondhand shop in a very old neighborhood of narrow, colorful streets called Le Panier. Her block has artist studios, restaurants, boutiques, and she says it's already seen how damage to a destination's reputation can really hurt business, which she says is already slow. People on the cruises, she says, they're told on the boats that there are thieves here. These clichés from 20 years ago. It's to be expected that there would be some controversy over the portrayal of violence and poverty in the city. But people also object to the depictions of Marseille high society in the series. Scheherazade Guenifa is sitting at a cafe across from the old Stock Exchange building that stars as City Hall in the series. It's what we'd call chic Marseille, says Guenifa, who's from here and works as a chef. Like a lot of people without Netflix subscriptions, she's only seen the two episodes that have aired on a French TV channel. Marseille is very cultural, she says. The population is very mixed. And I really want that to be represented in the series. For the moment, I haven't seen that yet. So I'm waiting to see the rest. And there will be more. Netflix just renewed Marseille for a second season. One last complaint from just about everyone I spoke with. Nobody here thinks the actors get the local accent right. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Marseille.
You're listening to The World. Rivers of garbage. That's how some people have described the streets of the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The city's been dealing with a major trash crisis for a while now. It began last year when the region's only landfill shut down. People started dumping trash wherever they could. That's when one activist saw the chance to get people to think differently about their waste. The World's Ari Daniel caught up with her recently in Beirut.
Okay, you see here? This is all the aluminium, and this is the plastic.
Shadia Khater is standing inside what used to be an indoor basketball court. Only now it's stacked with all kinds of trash. Metal, glass, paper, and plastic.
All this can be recyclable.
This is the recycling facility for the Beirut suburb of Beit Ashar, and Khater, who runs a plumbing and HVAC contracting company, is its founder.
Make me feel happy.
She's happy. Because in Lebanon, household recycling has been almost unheard of, until now, due to a situation that's spun out of control.
Now we're driving along the Beirut riverbed.
This is Ziad Abishaker, and this is no double-decker sightseeing tour. Abishaker runs an NGO called Cedar Environmental. Can you describe what it looks like?
A huge mound of waste that is just being thrown alongside the riverbed.
Almost a year ago, the actual dump for about 3 million people in and around Beirut closed its gates.
The way they were dumping the waste there was not according to good practices. There were a lot of odors emanating. Methane gas generation was not being managed well. So people were really getting sick from these toxic gases.
Abishakar says the whole situation also stank of corruption, with politicians giving one company a monopoly on trash collection and getting kickbacks. Once the dump closed, though, there was nowhere to put the trash. Collection stopped, and people started chucking their trash wherever they could. It was filthy and dangerous, and all of a sudden, something most Lebanese had never been concerned with became a problem.
Now your options are very limited. Either gonna bathe in your own garbage, or you're gonna start looking at it differently. The best way to adapt is when you are in a crisis.
One obvious solution might be for people to just produce less trash, but Abishakar says that's a very hard change to make. He says most of the trash people are producing, though, can be recycled. Which leads us back to Shadia Khatter's new recycling center, where a team of workers flanking a conveyor belt sorts the metals, plastics, and glass. After that, everything gets packed up and sold to industrial recyclers. Like I said, this type of local facility is kind of a new thing here in Lebanon. But Khatter says getting the operation up and running was the easy part compared to getting her neighbors to even think about sorting their trash for recycling.
This is the most difficult part of all the story, to change the mind of the people.
Khatter's approach has been nothing short of a blitzkrieg.
Look, for example, here.
So you've got a big notebook here.
Yes.
Every house and apartment in Beit Ashar is in the notebook. Khatter and her team went door to door in the town to explain the importance of sorting and recycling. Not surprisingly, they met resistance from folks who just didn't want to bother. So with one community, she got provocative.
I had the idea to put my car and to block the road, and they couldn't go out anymore to go to school, to work.
Khatter only moved her car when people started sorting their trash on the spot. Another time, she asked a priest to discuss recycling in his homily and then sat in the front row of the church to make sure he followed through on his promise. He did. Khatter says the result of her efforts and others like it has been a slow turn towards recycling in this suburb and elsewhere in Lebanon. Now, only time will tell if the trend will continue. Her new business isn't making money yet. And in many communities in the Beirut area, regular trash pickup has started again, with the waste headed for both old and new landfills. That's good for the dumping crisis, but maybe not so good for recycling. Like Khatter said, it's tough to get people to continue to sort when there's an easier option. But she believes that the sheer volume of trash here remains a real problem, one that may eventually allow recycling to take real root in Lebanon.
I hope it will be a turning point. And I hope from the bottom of my heart that we can do it this way, because it's the correct way to do.
For the World, Ari Daniel, Beirut.
Here's a blast from the past. It was 35 years ago this weekend that swashbuckling archaeologist Indiana Jones first burst onto the big screen. Fitting then that today we had the announcement of a huge discovery at one of the ancient sites where one of the Indy movies was filmed. The site is Petra in Jordan. It was used in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, and you've seen the desert city in a bunch of other movies as well. The world's history guy Chris Wolf is cracking the whip on this one. So what exactly has been found, Chris, and what does it look like?
Well, they found multiple structures, but one of them is literally monumental. It's a giant rectangular platform, like much of ancient Petra, which was known to the poets, as I'm sure you remember, as a rose-red city half as old as time. So it's part built and part hewn out of the red-tinted sandstone hills that the city's built on. It's like 60 yards by 50 yards, so that's about as wide as a football field and about half as long. And on top of that, supported by a mass of columns on one side and a set of giant stone steps on the other, is a second, smaller platform, about the size of an Olympic swimming pool. And on top of that is another relatively small structure, also supported in part by columns, but you can't see any of it yet. It's yet to be excavated.
So do we know what it is?
No one knows for sure, but the authors of the article on the new research, which is published in the Journal of the American Schools of Oriental Research, suggest a ceremonial use, possibly religious. It's kind of oriented to the east, not towards the city centre. Its builders, the Nabataeans, are believed to have incorporated some kind of sun worship into their religion, and later on, obviously, it was useful for Christians in that part of the world.
So how does a thing this size get buried, and why was it hidden for so long?
Well, Petra was in use until about the time of the Arab conquest in the 7th century. There was a series of earthquakes as well, so the city was abandoned and then consumed. The region is famous for its sandstorms, so you can imagine it getting buried pretty quickly.
And how did it get found?
Well, the article is called Hiding in Plain Sight. So literally, this thing was there all the time, but nobody could see it because nobody had thought to have a look from the air. So what they did was actually, it's a BBC-supported experiment to use Google Earth Pro to actually try and look at archaeological sites, well-known archaeological sites, for new stuff. And so they found some multiple structures, which they investigated further using drones and ground-sensing imagery, and then did some ground truthing with archaeological teams doing several trips to the ground itself to just see what they could find.
Is there any sense of who built the structure?
Well, it's definitely the Nabataeans. Now, you may not remember who the Nabataeans...
No, never heard the Nabataeans.
Well, they're kind of the people who lived in the transitional zone between, like, Arabia and the Fertile Crescent countries of Iraq and Syria. Mm-hmm. And so as they got richer through trade, they pushed into the more fertile areas and built themselves a kingdom which lasted for several centuries. And they're believed to have been like, well, no one's really sure. They're a mix of Aramaic and Arabic in their ethnicity.
Now, we hear Middle East monuments in the news these days, and we think destruction of monuments by groups like ISIS. Are they anywhere near close to Petra?
No, well, Petra is in Jordan, and
right.
Jordan so far has been unaffected directly by ISIS, although they are involved in the coalition effort to fight them. But so far, so good.
The world's one-man history desk, Chris Wolf, thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
The Elemental Thing, shared by Tennessee, Moscow, and Japan. That's coming up later. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This summer, a first, a team of refugees will compete in the Olympics. Two of them are from Congo and compete in judo. A while back, they came to Brazil for a competition and stayed.
That was 2 years ago. Since then, they've got themselves on their feet. They started training judo again, and now they're going to be in the Olympic Games.
Their story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston.
The champ is here! Ali! Ali!
Fans turned out today in Louisville, Kentucky, to say farewell to boxing legend Muhammad Ali. Ali's reach was truly global. For example, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan flew to Kentucky to attend yesterday's Muslim service for Ali. Earlier today, we spoke with reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul.
When we heard that he was going all the way to Kentucky, a lot of people here were pretty surprised just because it's a long way to go for a boxer's funeral who wasn't Turkish. But on his way out yesterday from the funeral prayer, President Erdogan had told reporters that basically it wouldn't do Ali's role in the Muslim world justice if he bid him goodbye from afar, that he really wanted to be there in person. And initially, President Erdogan had been slated to speak at the funeral service today along with the King of Jordan, and then the Ali family had decided not to have them speak. And so President Erdogan went to the prayer that was yesterday, but actually will not be attending the funeral service today.
So if you had to point to kind of why Erdogan and Turkey feel it's important for the president to be at this funeral, what would you point to?
So in 1976, Muhammad Ali visited Istanbul and prayed at the Blue Mosque with the then Turkish Prime Minister Necmettin Erbakan. So that was a really symbolic event, in particular because Erbakan hugged Muhammad Ali, and reportedly Ali said, "This was the first time a white leader has ever hugged me." That basically helped shape Turks' views of Ali, because Ali had said that he wanted to dedicate his life to propagating Islam and to promoting the faith as much as he could after that visit. For Turkey, he was not just a great sportsman, but this leader in the Muslim world. For example, Erdogan penned a tribute to Ali in Bloomberg. He had pointed to Ali's statement statements after 9/11. Basically, Ali had said, I'm devastated that the name of Islam is being used to promote violence. That's not what Islam is. And Erdogan really held up that view and called Ali a freedom fighter and a hero for promoting that message.
So how did Turks react when Ali died?
A lot of people were really devastated. I think they reacted the way a lot of the Muslim world did, which is this icon, this person that had represented them in some way and given a lot of them a voice in some way. There was an outpouring of support.
You suggested that maybe not all of Turkey was so enthused by Erdogan's trip to the Ali funeral. How do Turks feel about this trip?
After the prayer yesterday, Erdogan had made some statements to reporters, especially promoting Ali's choice to be a conscientious objector and not go and fight in the Vietnam War. And a lot of people criticized Erdogan because they said, you know, if a Turkish boy, a Turkish man was drafted to fight against the Kurds in the southeast, there's no way that Erdogan would be sympathetic to that conscientious objection.
It's also been reported that Fethullah Gulen, the anti-Erdogan cleric based in the U.S., was invited to the funeral. And just last week, interestingly, Erdogan's government put Gulen on their terrorist watch list. Did the invitation of Gulen make the rounds in Turkish media? Did it spark any debates?
Oh, it totally made the rounds. I mean, it was totally one of those things where it was pitting Erdogan and Gulen, who are against each other, but it was definitely played up like, oh, what are they going to do? What's happening? It would have been very interesting if they ended up in the same room.
So whether or not Erdogan feels inclined to attend today's funeral, what do you think the takeaway is for Turks as their president tries to get some of that Muhammad Ali magic dust on him?
I think it's meaningful to some of his supporters that he was there representing the country and representing them as a Muslim country. Erdogan kind of fancies himself as a leader in the Muslim world, as an Islamic leader. He's really positioning himself as that kind of figure.
Dolly, would you say that Erdogan's critics in Turkey see him just capitalizing on the death of a kind of Muslim hero?
Oh, totally. Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are plenty of people who definitely say that Erdogan's totally capitalizing on the death of this iconic athlete.
Reporter Dalia Mortada in Istanbul. Dalia, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Right now, Muslims across the globe are celebrating the holy month of Ramadan. For many, that means long summer days without food or water. And the demands of Ramadan are really hard for more than 50,000 Muslim refugees stuck in Greece. From Athens, Jean Carsonson has our story.
I'm standing in the Ramadan queue. There's about six lines of people waiting to get their food. It's just about sundown.
This is Piraeus Port in Athens. It's an informal tent camp that's home to about 1,000 people. It's the first night of Ramadan, the most important Muslim holiday. For 1 month every year, people fast all day until sundown, when they break the fast by sharing a traditional meal together. As the sun sets behind the massive ferries that take travelers to the Greek islands, hundreds of hot, tired refugees line up in front of a trailer in a vast parking lot. They haven't eaten or had a drink of water since 4 a.m. Hedda Grew is a volunteer with Team Sweden, a small NGO that provides tea and other support to the refugees.
All these families, anybody who wanted to participate in Ramadan could sign up for a special meal?
Yes, the special meal is a box. Basically, at about 8 o'clock when the sun is setting, we're going to hand out these boxes, which consist of the dinner, which you can eat immediately, and then a breakfast, which they can eat before the sun rises again. But it also consists of figs, which they use to break the fast with. So that's the first thing they eat.
It's clear the Greek government is trying to support the refugees during Ramadan. But even so, conditions at Piraeus are abysmal. Hedda Grew says the Ramadan fast is only increasing tensions among people who are already desperate about their circumstances.
They can't drink, they can't eat, they're just sitting in a hot tent all day. And it's a combination between the Ramadan and the waiting.
And there's an awful lot of waiting. I walk to a quieter area of the camp where I meet Amal Hare, a beautiful young mother of four from Aleppo.
My name Amal.
Amal.
Hope. Hope in English. I have a lot of hope. But now I must be strong, more strong. for my family.
Amal is putting on a positive face, but I can see the distress in her eyes. She tells me that Ramadan makes her long for home.
I want to go to Aleppo, to Ramadan, cooking and some cold water and good place, not this. Some fruit, good fruit, not orange every day. You don't love same food every day, yes?
Yes, I understand. A lot of people tell me that Ramadan is a very happy time of year.
Yes.
When you're with your family and special food and...
Yes, but I don't say what I can say to you because I am very sad now. Because I remember my house.
Hello.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Hi.
I'm Jean.
Hi.
The next night, I accept an invitation to a very different iftar meal. This is Anna Stamu. She's Greek and converted to Islam. She's married to Naim El Gandour, president of the Muslim Association of Greece. Naim was born in Egypt.
Everybody, I call for iftar, Muslim and non-Muslim. It is Ramadan.
You can break the fast with us also. Okay.
That's a Ramadan app on Naim's phone. It's sundown. We sit down to eat. Anna's mother is visiting and jokes that Naim's Egyptian salad is really Greek.
This is the Egyptian rice. It has all kinds of vegetables you can put in a salad, like lettuce and tomato and carrots and pepper.
The salad is from Greece, please.
No. It's totally Egyptian salad.
Over iftar dinner, Anna translates for Naim as he speaks Greek. He's sad for the thousands of Muslim refugees having to celebrate Ramadan in the camps. But he tells me he's glad to see that Yanis Mousalis, the Greek minister of migration, is making an effort to show support during Ramadan.
That he will respect Ramadan for the refugees, serve the food, the morning fasting, the break of the fast. It is very encouraging for us.
The refugees are in a terrible situation in Greece. But Naim, who fled his native Egypt in 1967, is grateful that they're at least away from the violence.
They're way better than if they were there, and maybe a bomb would be in their head right now, and they would celebrate no Ramadan, no nothing.
But the best Ramadan blessing would be to end the fighting.
I wish there would be a solution with Europe to stop the war. Because this is the issue, to stop the war, and all of them want to go back. So now, you have to stop, you have to eat, because we have some tea after.
Okay, wonderful.
I say goodbye to Naim and Anna, but I keep thinking about Amal, the mother I met in the camp at Piraeus. It's not easy to feel your dignity slipping away, especially during the holidays.
You know how this or any people here lived? Like animal. But maybe someone can help these people.
I wish I could bring her cool water and freshly peeled oranges from Aleppo for Ramadan. For The World, Jean Carstensen, Athens, Greece.
For another smaller group of refugees, things are actually looking up this summer. That's because for the first time, athletes who are refugees will have the chance to compete in the Olympics. The refugee Olympic team will march under its own banner when the games kick off in Brazil in August. Our correspondent in Rio de Janeiro is Will Carlos, and he met some refugee athletes who are already there getting ready for the games. Tell us who you met, Will.
Yeah, we got this great chance to go and meet Yolande Bakusa, Obuhusa Mabika, and Popole Misenga. There are a couple of athletes.
Are you kidding me?
I thought I did pretty well with those names there. There are a couple of athletes from the Democratic Republic of Congo who ended up in Brazil in 2013 and have been living here as refugees ever since. And I spoke to Yolande, and she was really emotional. She had this to say.
Tô mais feliz de novo para essa campeonato Olimpíada, vou lutar Olimpíada para.
So she says, I'm happy again for this Olympic competition. I'm going to fight in these Olympics to defend all the refugees in the world. I'm not just training here to lose. I'm training for victory. God will lift up all refugees to get a good result.
So how does an Olympic judo competitor like Yolande from Congo end up in Brazil? What's her story?
It's a very interesting story, rather sad. They came in 2013 for the World Cup of Judo, along with two other representatives of the judo team from Congo. The two other representatives, who I believe were the coach and sort of an official, they absconded and they took everybody's money and everybody's passports with them. So Yolande and Popole woke up and they've been told that they were going off for a few hours and they didn't come back. And after 3 days, Yolande told me she wandered out literally into the street. She went to find anybody who had black skin like hers, she said. And she literally walked up to anybody who had dark skin and said, in French, because she didn't speak Portuguese, here's my situation. Eventually, she was directed towards this beauty salon where there were known to be people who were from Africa working there. And she slept on the floor of this beauty salon. They both did for 4 days. And then they were introduced eventually to the local Congolese population, some of whom are refugees themselves. And that's how that was 2 years ago. Since then, they've got themselves on their feet. They started training judo again, and now they're going to be in the Olympic Games.
Presumably some of the other refugee athletes will be coming from places that are not their home countries. And they're people without countries. Are they in refugee camps and coming to the Olympics?
I'm not sure about the other people. I believe there are a couple who have been in refugee camps. But the whole idea of this is that they're going to be this, you know, this kind of conglomerate of people from all over the world who are under this refugee banner. So they'll be marching, for example, under the Olympic flag. Their anthem will be, I believe, the Olympic anthem. I had suggested something by the Fugees, but I guess right. They're going to go with the Olympic anthem.
Well, I'm kind of wondering what was behind the IOC decision to create an Olympic refugee team this year, because it does feel like 2016, 2015 is the year of the refugee with everything that's in the news. Do you think the IOC was maybe trying to recognize that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what they're doing. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for sort of grabbing hold of something that really kind of signifies the whole Olympic story. I mean, especially with this Olympics in Brazil, most of the time we talk about it, we're talking about it in these sort of negative terms about all the problems and everything else. And here, I think, is a story that really does embody the Olympic spirit.
Finally, before I let you go, Will, what's the update on preparations for the Games? 2 months away. How are things looking?
Well, let's get back to the negative now, I suppose. I mean, the big news in Rio de Janeiro right now is that the main road that they just opened with a lot of fanfare between Copacabana and Ipanema over to the main Olympic site, after a day, it had huge potholes in it. So they had to then shut it down, and they've been working to patch it all up. Apparently this morning they've put some metal sheets across it as sort of a temporary solution. I think that embodies kind of where we are right now. I think once the sun comes out, hopefully people will start getting a bit more positive about these games that are just around the corner.
The world's Will Carlos in Rio. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Mark. Always a pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Naming an element on the periodic table is not a straightforward process. Take the story of Nihonium, which this week finally got dubbed after Nihon, the Japanese word for Japan. But get this, Nihonium was first spotted by Japanese scientists more than a decade ago. So what took so long? Eric Sherry is a chemistry professor at UCLA. What is Nihonium, first of all, Eric?
Well, it's one of these very unstable, super heavy elements, as you just mentioned, discovered something like 10 years ago. But these events are so rare that they have to go through very, very careful checks, and that's why it takes a long time.
So how big of a deal is the element's name, Nihonium, for Japanese scientists?
I think it's a very big deal. In fact, it occurred to me that this was almost the scientific equivalent to Hillary Clinton becoming the first woman to be nominated for U.S. presidential election.
I mean, wow, why so important?
Well, it's the first time an Asian country has been credited with the discovery of an element. It's certainly the first time an Asian country has had an element name associated with it. Never happened before. Science has been a pretty much exclusively Western affair, at least as far as naming of elements has been concerned.
It's interesting. Element number 117 was also named this week, Tennessine, because of major research contributions from the state of Tennessee. And I didn't see anything about that in the news. Even today, it's a really scant coverage. So how big a deal was this in the evening news in Tokyo, do you think?
I would think they're extremely proud of this, and rightly so. They have an element. It's wonderful. It may be worth pointing out that many years ago, in fact, way back in 1908, a Japanese chemist was working in London under a famous chemist called Ramsey, and he claimed to have discovered an element, and his professor told him, well, you should call it nipponium. And he did call it nipponium. And this element was talked about and appeared on periodic tables for a while. But then it turned out to be spurious.
Right. And nippon, it's also a Japanese word referring to Japan, isn't it?
Absolutely. And there's an odd little regulation. The regulation states that if a name has been used once before and the element turned out to be spurious, you can never use the name again. So in a way, that name is being used again with the slight difference that the name, instead of being nipponium, is now being given as nihonium. In fact, nihonium, I believe, is the way that some of the Japanese pronounce the word and that some others actually say nipponium.
Wow. Interesting little loophole. So the rules, I understand, also allow elements to be named after mythical creatures, not just places. Are any elements actually named after mythical creatures?
Well, I suppose thorium, a rather important element.
Named after Thor, the Scandinavian god.
Yeah.
That's the only one?
That's the only one I can think of off the top of my head. There are some that are named after goblins, nickel. The meaning derives from a German word called a devil or a goblin. All kinds of things, after colors, after obviously countries, after locations. There are four elements that are named after one Swedish village in which they were all discovered. And so there are variations on the name of that village. Iterby is the name of the village. And so you have Iterbium.
Wow, this is fascinating. So to that question, because I was saying earlier that nihonium was first identified more than 10 years ago, what took so long to get here?
Well, the checks and balances that are carried out, the committee meetings. In many of these cases, the discoveries were actually shared by a number of labs. So not only must the science be checked, but there's some sort of horse trading of a kind that goes on in order to decide who shall have the right to name a particular element.
The thing that you pointed out, the fact that this is the first element, not just discovered in Asia, but the first one discovered outside of Europe or North America, does this represent anything bigger for non-Western science as a whole?
Well, it's symbolic. I mean, non-Western science has been happening for quite some time. It's not the first time non-Western science has made a contribution, but this is highly symbolic because of the status of the periodic table, this sort of sacred chart for chemists and physicists and, in fact, all scientists. To actually be enshrined on that table is the significant thing.
Eric Sherry is the author of The Periodic Table, Its Story and Significance. Thanks very much for telling us about nihonium.
You're quite welcome. Nice talking to you.
Let's get out of here today with some indie rock from Iceland, a band called Kaleo. And if you don't know them now, relax. There's a good chance, having heard this, you'll be on the early money by the end of the summer. Kaleo is barnstorming its way across America, playing sold-out shows. When you get the vibration, won't be no good, won't be no good. You better start rolling when you hear the man coming, won't be. Just 4 years ago, Kaleo was getting its act together in a small Icelandic town of only 9,000. They toiled away in relative obscurity, but then with the help of YouTube, an appearance at South by Southwest, and tons of rave reviews, Kaleo started getting its name out there. J.J. Júlíusson, the lead singer, says their moment came when Kaleo covered a traditional Icelandic ballad during a live radio show.
It's called Vori Vaklaskoi, and it's just a really beautiful poem, and it's a love story between, you know, a couple, and what's beautiful about it is really how it describes the moment, this, you know, spring night that they're having in this forest. And I think that really led people to start listening to the other songs and kind of discovering the band itself.
Kaleo has played some interesting venues. The band shot a live performance of its song Way Down We Go from, and you're not going to believe this, 400 feet inside a volcano in Iceland.
That was a fun experience. We did that last summer, and I think it took 26 hours to get all the gear down there, shoot the video, and get everyone out. And, you know, obviously, the volcano, the acoustics from there, that was special.
Their debut international release is also pretty special. It's called A.B., and it's out today.
Whoa, you let your feet run wild. Thomas, come as we all go down.
We've got some great Kaleo videos at PRI.org, and yes, that includes Way Down We Go, the volcano concert. Again, check it out at PRI.org. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you right here on Monday.
Someday we run you down, down to the floor.
PRI, Public Radio International.